Welcome to the Regional Hospital Voice, where every episode we sit down with hospital leaders to unpack what's really happening inside regional hospitals across America. Regional hospitals are the backbone of American healthcare, and being a hospital leader is one of the toughest jobs in the industry. You're often asked to do twice as much with half the resources larger health systems have, yet you carry a critical mission. These hospitals are the lifeline of their communities, and their work matters to this country more than most people realize. This isn't just about diving into the challenges, though there are many. We're here to talk about what's working, what leaders are doing to expand access, and how they're making real progress against the odds. I'm glad you're here. This is the Regional Hospital Voice. Welcome to another episode of the Regional Hospital Voice. Today, I'm honored to have a truly remarkable guest, Angela Hanley, CEO of Clint Memorial Hospital in Homerville, Georgia. Angela's story is one you don't hear enough in the healthcare leadership. She started out at the bedside as a nurse and worked her way to the CEO of a hospital. In just this month, Clint Memorial was recognized by the Georgia Hospital Association with an award that reflects the kind of leadership and community commitment we celebrate on this show. Angela, thank you so much for being here. It's an honor and privilege to have you on the Regional Hospital Voice.
Well, thank you, Mark, for inviting me. I appreciate it. It is a great honor to be here today.
Well, before we get into anything else, I saw the news on LinkedIn last week about the Georgia Hospital Association Award. And I wanted to kind of start right there because, you know, it's these moments that deserve to be celebrated.
I was so honored to receive that award, and our team was so excited. And, you know, Mark, I've been here 9 years this September. And if it were up to me, the staff would get an award every day. But to have such an organization like the Georgia Hospital Association give Clint Memorial Hospital, a small critical access hospital, that award, It's our team is just so proud and so thankful. We are very honored and we're very grateful for it.
Well, fantastic. Well, of course, that's a wonderful foundation. I really love what you said about the staff deserving an award every day. You know, now I'd love to really kind of hear a little about your story because, you know, I understand you kind of came into leadership on the clinical side, starting out as a nurse.
That's right. I graduated from nursing school several years ago. I'm not going to tell you exactly when, but I've been in the healthcare profession for over 20 years now. So I started out at the bedside as a surgical intensive care nurse. And over the years, I have been able to fill different positions at the bedside, but also in managerial roles. So I've worked in plastic surgery. I have also worked in psych. I've worked med-surg, float pool, special projects, et cetera. I ran the gamut, and I really do think that helped prepare me to be a CEO of a hospital. I appreciate everyone's perspectives. And one of the things that I wanted to say, if I had the opportunity to give a speech at GHA, was that I feel like I am so honored to be in such an elite group of healthcare leaders. We all bring something different to the table. We all have different perspectives and work experience that make us great collectively and also individually. But really, being a nurse and being on that side, I'm able to speak a language that I think some people who are not in healthcare aren't. So, you know, if I go to the bedside and I see a lot of busyness, I feel like I'm able to detect, okay, they need a little help here when I go out on the floor. And then also when they say, well, you're just so incredibly busy, I can say, well, how do you quantify busyness? Because I'm not quite so sure you and I define it as the same thing. And so I think this really helped me a great deal during my time here.
Well, fantastic. Well, and kind of tell me a little about, you know, how it's a little bit different because of the lens that you have starting out as a nurse, as you kind of walk the rounds, as you will, as a CEO. What are a couple of things that you see a little bit differently?
Well, and I know some people think I am crazy about this, but I'm a stickler for the uniform, Mark. I mean, that's just one of the things that I am a stickler for, and I will hone into that. If it was up to me, and I know I'm going to get a lot of hate, I sit on the Georgia Nursing Foundation committee to the board for that. But I love the traditional uniform. starch white, and I know the hat, but I love that entire look. And I am part of an organization where we do a special ceremony at nurses' funerals when they pass away. And so when we walk in that uniform, I mean, I see people sitting up a little bit straighter. There's a little recognition, like that uniform demands respect. So I look at those things when I go on the floor. If you're not taking time to care about the way you present yourself to the patient, I think that does speak volumes. And I know a lot of people don't feel that way. I know it's very hard for us to do 3 12-hour shifts and come in here, and it's all we can do to get in here. But you know what? The military doesn't cut any slack about their uniform. And there are a lot of places when I go through a McDonald's drive-thru, there is a uniform. I've had kids who worked in fast food, Zaxby's, Chick-fil-A, and they were sent home if they didn't obey the dress code. So when we are representing a profession that saves lives, I think there should be a very high standard for how we present ourselves to, because it does help the nurse gain respect from that, or presenting compliments, or when they want to say something about the care they received, or they have questions for me, I feel like I'm better prepared to answer those.
I totally agree. It definitely, you know, demands respect, and that professional standard is so important. And so kind of tell me, you know, something that you're proudest of right now, you know, a strategy or a program or the people, you know, who make it happen, as you mentioned in the beginning, of what other regional hospital leaders might want to kind of steal from you.
Well, recently we are able to promote some of our staff within. So I now have a chief operating officer, and I also have a chief clinical officer, and we have had a CFO. But that, and I know a lot of people go, well, why is she mentioning that? Because for the last 9 years, Mark, it has been nothing but pure survival every single day. And I'm not going to take away from that, because I still think it is. But every day it was like, whoever has the most available time, you handle that fire, and you have that fire. And we really were not able to focus on job specific things. And we did get a lot of projects across the finish line, but how much better could we have been at that if we could be very specific in what our assignment is? So I'm so proud of the fact that we do have that executive representation now, so that we can focus on the things that are assigned to us, and that we know what our role is. But to me, that is huge, because for our hospital, 9 years ago, and walked in the door, that we are told that we are pending closure, imminent closure, because of the multi-year million dollar losses that we had experienced so many years in a row. And that was my second month as CEO when I heard that. So I was just devastated.
Wow.
And there have been so many things that have happened that every other hospital has experienced with that. But, you know, we've had to kind of do it without that executive leadership. We've had to assign tasks to maybe some people, to some people that may not have been ready for that. And so maybe we've had some bad outcomes, or maybe we should have been more strategic in those assignments. But that is just something we're extremely proud of. The second thing I want to talk about is our pediatric ER certification or designation that we recently achieved. Okay. So we are the first critical access hospital in the state of Georgia to receive that designation. The first hospital south of Macon to achieve that designation, and the first hospital in the Children's Healthcare of Atlanta and Mercer University cohort to achieve that designation. And when the auditors came, they really did compliment our staff. And I know that they're supposed to do that to an extent, but they said, really, the effort and the attention to detail that you have put into this program and to all the policies and procedures, she said, we are rare to find that in the larger urban hospitals. And so our team was just so proud of that. And they were invited to be surveyors for that designation and follow-up hospitals. And I am just so proud of that achievement. And that designation doesn't mean that our little critical access hospital can care for any pediatric emergency that comes in, but we are prepared to at least assess, triage, identify, and then get you to that higher level of care than we were 2 years ago, 5 years ago, and so forth. And we need that in our rural hospital.
You know, that's fantastic, because too often I hear about services being cut instead of added. And so, and, you know, and just kind of taking, going back for a second, because you mentioned coming in as your second month as a CEO and almost facing that foreclosure. I mean, what steps did you start to take to try to build your way out of that?
Oh, gosh. I remember going home that first night crying all the way home.
Wow.
And it was a 45-minute drive because I was like, they didn't hire me because they thought I was brilliant. They hired me to be the scapegoat for the closure of this hospital. This is my first role as a CEO. I've been at the bedside and this is what's happening. But my life and my past experiences, I think of constant survival, really prepared me to say I remember pulling into the garage and I'm like, okay, Angela, this is the last tear you're going to shed about this. It's time to get to work. And we're not going to let this happen. At that time, I think we had 95 employees. And then there is this really hard drive to prove to everyone that I am capable of doing this job and I'm not going to let it close. So we just pivoted and we shifted and we created alliances and we started creating a network. And one thing about me, and a lot of people will say this, I'm the one who asked the question in the room, whether a lot of people go, gosh, that's a stupid question for a CEO to ask. I don't care. If I'm unsure, I'm going to ask the question. And I will be the first to call and ask for help if I need it. I'm not going to sink or I'm not going to put on airs because I don't want anybody to think that I'm something that I'm not. I'll call and say, Mark, I'm lost. I just listened to this podcast and I know I'm the CEO of 20 plus years, but can you explain to me the terminology? Can you explain that to me? Can you come in and help? And I think being that vulnerable and being willing to admit when I need help, when I don't know something really truly has helped build the culture that we have here, because that's the culture that I've tried to embed, is that I don't want you to have all the answers. I just want you to be able to get them and admit that you don't know. And so I think that, and then we would not be here today if it wasn't for the people, the other CEOs, the experts in the field, our vendors, our support staff who agreed to help me and to say yes and to take the multiple phone calls. And let me explain this one more time to you, Angela, sometimes with patience and sometimes not, but I give them all the credit for that too, of being patient with me. So that's what we did. I think a lot of people are just so afraid to admit when they don't know something, and that can be a huge, huge impediment to success going forward. So I would say to anyone who finds themselves in that position, if you don't know, if you're swimming and if you're overwhelmed, sometimes just calling someone who's in the same field and hearing, Angela, right where you were 10 years ago. This is the first thing that I would look at. Angela, let's look at your service line. And so people doing that and the mentor who helped me during that time doing that made me commit to paying that forward for the rest of my life. So whenever someone needs help, we're right there to answer their questions. I send staff to try to help them. Anytime another CEO reaches out, I do my best to be available to them just because of the help that we've received over the years. And hopefully so that we can make sure we keep those networks open for the help that we're going to need in the future.
Well, that's powerful. And yes, I love everything, you know, really asking the right questions and not being scared to ask the question, I think is so important.
I don't know why leaders are so afraid to admit they don't know something.
Well, especially in your field, like I had a gentleman, his name was Aaron. I mean, he had a powerful statement. He says, you know, hospitals are under more compliance and regulation than nuclear energy.
Oh, I will attest to that. I believe that wholeheartedly. And there is no way that we can afford, with our limited budgets, to be able to hire the expertise that we need to meet all those regulations and to understand the laws that apply to us and to understand all the new legislation and rules. So we depend heavily on a network that's available to us, but they're not going to freely give that information. You have to ask for it.
Yes. Yes. Well, and every leader, you know, I talk to raises the reimbursement, you know, as a lot of the weight that they carry. You know, what does that look like for Clinch? Because you talked about how they were almost closing as you came on. And we know about the reimbursement challenges, but what are you seeing, whether it's Medicare Advantage, managed Medicaid, or just not being paid at the same rate as a larger health system for the same service?
Well, one of the things that we struggle with is delayed payments. And so, you know, critical access hospitals and rural hospitals, we are, deemed healthy by the day's cash on hand. And I think it's frustrating with a lot of our payers because there will be a denial for the slightest thing. and that's going to extend the payment for another 45 days. And rural hospitals and critical hospitals are already reimbursed at a much lower rate for the same procedures in a larger urban hospital, which I don't understand that. That's one of the things that I could ask for, and there's a magic wand, and you want to talk about viability and survival of the rural hospital, let us get reimbursed the same amount that larger urban hospitals are getting reimbursed for. Why should my CT scan cost about 50% less or being reimbursed in an urban hospital setting? So the slow payment, the denials, because they know that we have limited staff. We don't have the team of experts and the systems that can automatically rebut that. That is one of the things that I would really like to see change, is that we would get reimbursed at a quicker level. And also at the same amount. Medicare Advantage to the critical access hospital has been devastating. And a lot of people don't understand this. So critical access hospitals and the reimbursement was set up so that we can get 101% of every cost for every Medicare dollar. The way that that rule is currently written, it's only for traditional Medicare that we're getting that reimbursement. CMS does not recognize that reimbursement for Medicare Advantage. So every single day of our practice, we are supposed to accept Medicare Advantage as Medicare. It's supposed to look like it, smell like it, talk like it, and walk like it until the critical access hospital reimbursement, which is completely unfair to our cause. If that could change, I mean, that could really save hospitals too. So when you think about my Medicare, traditional Medicare utilization used to be around 72%, and currently it's around 33%.
Wow.
So that shift to the Medicare Advantage plans in our community has really impacted us significantly. So whereas all the cost for all the Medicare reimbursement that, or whatever we supplied for Medicare recipients, used to get reimbursed at 101%. Used to be 77% of my book of business. Now it's dropped to 33% because of the shift to the Advantage plans. And when that rule was written for reimbursement to critical access hospitals, Medicare Advantage wasn't even a twinkle in anyone's eye, so it didn't exist. And I don't think a lot of people understand that little rule, that one sentence that's in that playbook.
No, and even in our study, we hit on so many elements of just the massive thorns on for every, especially critical access hospital at Medicare Advantage. I mean, yeah, between the prior authorization increase, between the delayed payments you just mentioned, not to mention the denied payments, and all the hoops and the friction that they get, they're supposed to act like traditional Medicare, but we know there's nothing like it at all. But then, yes, it impacts your cost report. It impacts your Medicare bad debt report. It just goes on and on and on, and it's just absolutely devastating.
It does, and the patients don't see that side, and they shouldn't. I mean, they trust that they have this insurance. They can go to the hospital. They can seek the service. They receive the service, and then it's done, but they don't see the multiple hours that it costs to get paid for that service, and then getting denied thousands of dollars, and you having to write that off. So that really impacts our ability to continue to provide that service, to employ people within the community, and to be able to expand on services. It's just a really, really unfair and horrible roller coaster ride that I wish we could get off. And the never-ending roller coaster. I don't do roller coasters anyway because I get horribly sick. So when I think about a parallel or comparison to that, that's what I think of. It's just like a never ending.
Well, you mentioned two things, not just Medicare Advantage, but also just the reimbursement rates and how it needs to be fair because you're providing the same service. And a lot of times you're having to also pay a little bit more for the recruitment of the clinician because, you know, typically they stay where their residency programs are, or the colleges. And not to mention you're paying more for the same box of gloves because you don't get the group purchasing deals. So right. When you add it all up, you're paying more for that service, but yet you're getting reduced significantly less reimbursement.
Right. And the contract nursing, which really reared its head during COVID, and now we almost can't get away from that. So we are still, our cost for nursing has just risen more than what healthcare ever thought it would be. But guess what? We have to employ nurses, CNAs, rad techs, teleradiologists, and hospitalists, and they're not going to go, you're located in Homerville, Georgia, so we're going to reduce our salary by $150,000. They don't do that. We have to pay the same amount to recruit very good providers to our area, and yet we're receiving smaller reimbursements for those services. how is that ever going to work?
And yes, that's the question to ask. And I want to jump on the clinician shortage, because I love to get your feedback being a nurse. But one thing I want to go back to is just, you know, the importance of how we have to educate our lawmakers. And obviously you're close with the Georgia Hospital Association. And I've also seen you at the CEO Capital Day through Hometown Health, of trying to make sure that we work on state issues, but we also need to work on the federal issues. And so what do you see as how we need to really educate our lawmakers about what's going on in our hospitals?
You know, that this conversation has come up multiple times, and I'm a nurse, so I can speak about the salary of a nurse. And I always told everyone, whenever I was precepting students, whenever I was a mentor to a nurse, I'm like, why are you getting into this profession? You know, I say, if it's the money, I need you to turn around and walk right out the door. We will never get paid what we deserve. And this is really a selfless job. This is a job of being a servant to somebody else. You have to really be passionate about what you do, because it's entire 12 hours that you're here at the bedside, your patient needs you. Okay, you need to have that understanding. And so when we started paying these huge contract amounts during the height of COVID, and that sustained, I think there's this mindset that nurses and CNAs and everyone is supposed to be making that amount. Okay, just because it can happen or it is allowed doesn't mean that it should continue. And I used this analogy one time, and I did receive some boos when I was speaking to a group of nurses one time. I said, healthcare was never made to sustain this kind of salary support for nursing. And they were like, why not? I said, okay, it's just like the rainforest. You can go in and cut down every tree. That is allowable. You can do it. It doesn't mean that it's good for the environment or for the people that are coming after that. And we have seen the impacts of that, Mark. Yes, we have continued to pay these salaries, and people are getting paid very good salaries, and they've adjusted to this new wage income. But what have you seen across America? OB units are being shut down.
Yep.
Pediatric units are being shut down. And because hospitals have to cut those service lines that are really not revenue makers, that they were services to the community. OBGYN, pediatrics, they are not revenue makers in any hospital. But when you say, you know what, my salary for our healthcare employees has increased 72%, where are we going to cut? So now patients are driving 200 miles to deliver their babies.
Yes.
When there's a pediatric emergency, you're driving over an hour because the hospital had to cut those services. This is the result of that. So there has to be some kind of cap. There has to be a medium here that we all need to meet. And there are some days, and I contract with several contract staffing, and so I'm contracted at a certain rate, and then we think we're all staff for the day, but if another hospital says, hey, I'll pay you this amount, they pull that staff. The contract company then places that nurse or tech at another hospital, and we're scrambling for staffing that day because we couldn't pay the X amount that another urban hospital could pay, and that's just really unfair. I mean, it impacts healthcare every day. It does impact patient outcome. It impacts our ability to staff on a regular basis. And unfortunately, you just find areas to cut in order for you to keep up with that and pay that. I want legislators to understand that.
Yeah, you bring up so many good points. And I was just in D.C. last week talking about the OB deserts. And, you know, it brings into the price pressures that you're experiencing as a hospital. And the number one is the rising personnel cost. And, you know, there's so much legislation they're talking about trying to cap, because looking at hospitals charge too much, which of course you're not reimbursed on what you're charged. But so much of that is your personnel because of this massive clinician shortage, where it's not just hospitals competing against each other, it's states competing against each other.
It is. And I think a lot of people just think that the hospitals are flush with all of this cash. We had over $2 million worth of bad debt last year at our hospital. So that means that people who came to our hospital, got the treatment that they needed, either had to be transported out, and we pay for every uninsured ambulance transport. We have to promise to pay for that transport, and we do. So you received your care, but then we didn't get reimbursed for it. So what business that you know of, like, and I use this analogy a lot, if you went into Target every day and you filled your buggy up and you went through the checkout and you go, you know what, I'm not going to pay you today.
Yeah.
Or if I do pay you, I'm going to set up on a $5 payment plan. and then go outside. And then if they want to come back within 30 minutes, they can do it and do it all over again. What businesses can be sustained with that kind of model? But hospitals are expected to do that. So if we could just focus on providing care for the patient, we would have unbelievable outcomes. But every single day, we have to find out what grants are available. Can we apply for them? Can we look for donors for our foundation? Can we have a fundraiser? Which product can we get the cheapest today? Can we modify our diets? And we have to really look at the food that we buy. What provider is selling it at the cheapest price this week? And do we need to modify the diets that we've created in order to save money somewhere? I mean, that every single day, that's what we're looking at every single day.
Well, it's clear, and I've said this on this podcast a few different times, where, you know, we talk about the social safety net in our country, and we often talk about Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, but we're not talking enough about our local community hospital, because when all else fails, and particularly if you can't afford your premiums, you can't afford your deductibles, you can't get the authorization you need because the insurer won't allow it, you become more acute, where's the only place you can go?
Go to the hospital.
Go to the hospital, yes. And yet you're not being compensated for that social safety net.
We aren't, and there are so many requirements of the things that we're supposed to provide. So for our hospital, there's a thing called EMTALA. If someone comes to our hospital, regardless of the ability to pay, regardless if they have $1,000 worth of debt, we are to provide care. We're not supposed to question. We're supposed to assess and triage. Which I will tell you, Mark, our hospital, that's the heart of who we are. We don't care what you look like, talk like, smell like. We want to be here to provide that care. I have the privilege of working with so many people who put the community first. But that's what we have to do. And then we have to meet all these guidelines and standards of whether or not we have an electronic health record. And now is something that's being presented very soon. I'm sure there's going to be cybersecurity standards. Are you able to meet those CISA standards, which can cost some hospitals hundreds of thousands of dollars? What happens to the rural hospital if you can't comply? There's going to be penalties waived, ransom and that type of thing. So, and people don't realize that we know what the impact would be if this hospital closed. So even though it's a very small town now, we do have some industry. If this hospital were to close, those industries could not stay here. They would close.
Yes.
And so this is happening all across America where we have these thriving small towns, but the hospital shuts down and the industries can't afford their work comp insurance. So they have to move out. And I don't think they understand that. I don't think they understand the economic viability that our hospital has by employing over 150 people. How does that feed into the economy, with the real estate, the grocery shopping, the school systems, and so forth? And I just think that people believe there's just this unlimited amount of money. I think some people may realize too late that we need a little bit more. There needs to be some legislation in place for the reimbursement. There needs to be some kind of safeguard for rural hospitals so that we can purchase at an affordable rate. For our staffing, it can be supplemented in an appropriate manner, because otherwise you're just putting Band-Aids on these big holes in the ship, and the water's eventually going to bust through that. And we got to fix the foundation of what's wrong.
Well, and that's what I was going to kind of dive into a little bit more. I mean, if you can make, you know, one change, a rule, a payment model, anything, you know, what really help hospitals like yours continue to provide the quality care you're providing and sustain it?
For the critical access hospital, if I could have one wish, please let us recognize Medicare Advantage as traditional Medicare in our cost report and get reimbursed for that amount. Okay. And then this part A of that is Medicare Advantage plans need to reimburse at the amount that Medicare does reimburse. If it's supposed to be Medicare, then reimburse at the same rate as Medicare.
Yeah, and I think that's another thing when I talk to lawmakers, when I explain that you have to negotiate your Medicare Advantage rates.
I know. And it's just so hard for us, for patients, because they think they have Medicare. They think they have this form of Medicare, and Medicare is supposed to be the greatest thing. They've worked for this all of their life. And they go into a hospital, and then you have to tell them, I'm sorry, that's not covered. We're going to have to send you home, or you're not going to be able to go into rehab, or you're not going to be able to go to the nursing home. And they're like, why not? I have Medicare. Like, yeah. No, ma'am, sir, you don't.
Well, and it's really the way they market those plans is predatory. and just how they're taking advantage of our seniors. So often they think they're signing up for a supplemental plan when it's actually a replacement plan, and they don't tell them about those negative consequences. And it's just really, you can just see how much money it's just making for those Wall Street insurers.
Well, my husband has Medicare, and the first thing that, and it's so funny, the first thing that I asked him when we were dating seriously, I said, what kind of insurance do you have? And he said, oh, I have Medicare. I said, let me see your card. He pulls it out. I'm like, this isn't Medicare. This is not a red, white, and blue. You have an Advantage plan. We're calling. We're changing this tomorrow. He's like, what? And I'm like, yes. And he had no idea, just a lack of understanding from that. But it's so funny when you talk about things, you know, long walks in the park or what's your favorite color. I'm like, what insurance do you have?
That's hilarious, Angela. One of those requirements.
I know.
Well, it sounds like, yeah, so you got them switched pretty quick.
I did. Yes, I did. Okay. And I'm so grateful. You know, my husband has this defect where he has heart failure. So he's had 7 pacemakers. And so we're about to go in for another one. And then last year, we started on the journey of heart transplant. UNF Shands, like, you know, we've done so many. Your ejection fraction continues to decrease. We really need to start working you up because we're not sure how much longer the pacemaker is going to be effective for you. And so we were denied that transplant because he was not as sick as others. And I understand that. And so we did an alternative thing. It's a brand new procedure. I think we were the second one that Shands Gainesville had put in. But they said, you know, we would love to do a lot more of these, except for, you know, we just, Medicare's just not approving them. I said, no, we have Medicare because we had the traditional Medicare. I said, I think it's the Advantage plans that are not approving them. So this life-saving device that's new that did improve his ejection fraction, they just could not get approvals for them. Mm. And so I'm just wondering how often that is happening throughout the country, that there are these life-saving procedures that need to happen. And, you know, we're talking about AI and how all of this, we can't keep up with the tech. Well, medical services are evolving too.
Yes.
And so it's evolving very quickly because of the advancements in AI and science. So to have a brand new service denied for a lot of people, I think is just very disheartening. And if my husband didn't have me to be able to speak to the medical side of that, to ask the questions and to talk about payments and the models and deductibles, co-pays, and what do you mean this needs a prior authorization or and things like that, I think a lot of people would just be lost and they would not get the services they need because they don't have an advocate readily available for them. But traditional Medicare has been very good for us with that. And I would hate to think that if he had kept the Advantage plan that he had, that surgery would have been denied.
Yes. Yeah, it is. And it's so important to get those stories out of, and I really love what you said earlier about how people work their whole life to obtain it. And then you hear someone's kind of getting in the middle and trying to take it, you know, almost away by restricting it, but they're profiting off of that restriction.
Well, they just don't understand. I know that, bless their hearts, they can't help it. They're sold this product. They're on a fixed income. They're comparing the 2 insurances, and you really, I can't afford this one because it's a very low premium. But on the back end, they don't realize what they're not going to get on the back end. And that's unfortunate for them.
I think that's the other thing is we need to continue not only to, you know, educate about Medicare Advantage and the harm that it creates, but we need to protect traditional Medicare. And one of the problems you just really outlined is the premiums, especially for the Part B, continues to increase. And so what's happening is it's not giving a good option for those seniors that can't afford it. And that's why we're seeing such a big migration to Medicare Advantage is because of those increases in traditional.
That's right. That's right. I wish there was some kind of supplement for Medicare recipients so they wouldn't have to switch. Like there, if you stay with traditional, then we'll give you this so much money. But I know that's not going to happen. I know there's a reason that the other plans are being developed. It's just unfortunate. I just think that in a country like ours, it should be up to our providers to decide our course of treatment.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think going back to what you said earlier about, you know, what you went through as you stepped into this role and trying to look back, you know, if you did have someone reach out to you that was going to be a new CEO that's kind of stepping into this role and asking for the help of what kind of what you talked about that you received, you know, what are some of the key points that you would tell them to be thinking about?
Really try to solidify who you are and don't worry about trying to keep up with everyone else or that you look like everyone else and that you dress and talk and are like comparing yourselves to all these other CEOs that are out there. We are so individual in the hospitals that we serve. Don't you think the leaders need to be a little individual too? And just because something that is working well at another hospital, it does not mean it's going to work well here. Our communities are so vastly different. And I see that. And it's just out of desperation is just trying to survive. You know, another hospital can develop or implement a service line and it's doing so well. You really have to be very careful and cautious and not implement it in your hospital unless you really know your community. Because you can invest hundreds of thousands of dollars and then it fail miserably. So know who you are and okay with being a little bit different and then really get to know the communities that you serve. We are not cookie cutter hospitals, okay? And the other thing that I would highly encourage is that you have to extend a lot of grace and mercy to your staff. It is so hard to recruit and retain the staff that we have. So one of the biggest investments that I think we've done over the last couple of years is we realized that we're not going to be able to pay these exorbitant salaries. We're not going to be able to recruit the people from the urban areas to come and help us. So we need to start growing our own. And so there are a lot of people in our organization, and I think in a lot of hospitals, that they are given the assignment of manager or director or leader, and they really were not equipped for that position. They were maybe the only one that applied or the only one that they could afford at the time, and that all the other managers already had 6 jobs. So why don't we just give this other job to Mark and let him be responsible for it? So we went back to the basics and we implemented a CMH management fundamentals class. And I did an assessment of some of the managers' pain points. What are the things that you wish that someone would have taught you or said to you earlier in the career? And I also did an evaluation of that for myself because, you know, I've been on my own since I was 15 years old. So I'm not the traditional CEO. I was a high school dropout and I was homeless on more than one occasion. So I've worked very hard to get where I am. And I think I would have gotten here much quicker if I had people being kind to me by having hard conversations and not just assuming that I knew something or that somebody else would tell me. So we started classes on how to compose an email, when you should answer emails. I had some people going, oh my gosh, all I can do is answer emails. I'm like, what are you doing? It's okay not to immediately respond. You're not here to answer emails all day. And so we had a class about setting a schedule of 9, 12, and 4, letting people know when you're going to respond. Why do we use the CMH brand? Because we paid a lot of money for it. We want people to be familiar with our brand and coloring. So when we say, use this signature and this font, only do that. And then when they heard the why behind it, they're like, oh, what's business casual? What behavior do we expect when you go to a conference? If you've never drank before, by God, please don't start drinking when you go to a conference when you're representing Clinchmore Hospital. Just be very careful about that. And I'm going to tell you something, the staff have been so appreciative of that. We recently invited a panel of judges down to judge an assignment that I gave them, you know, and we're all trying to survive. So staff are going, why don't we have this service line? Or why don't we start this? And why don't we start a dialysis program? So I gave them an assignment, the people who are in my class, and would say, you will either improve a current service line or you will start a new service line as long as it meets our mission. But these are the parameters. And I told them about the budgets and so forth. And said, it's just not an idea. You need to look at the return on investment. You need to vet the vendors. You need to talk about what specialists or specialties it would involve. And I said, you're going to present it to a very prestigious group of judges. And most of them have never spoken in front of a group before. And we were first practicing. I was like, oh my gosh, we're never going to get there. But we kept at it. We gave immediate feedback. We said, okay, stand up straighter. Look me in the eye. And I said, own what you're talking about. Believe in it because no one else is going to believe in that. And I'm going to tell you something. Those judges were so impressed at the end of this 90-day workshop of us working on it. And all of them say, Miss Angela, I think I can get up in front of anyone now and speak.
Oh, that's cool.
I understand what it means to develop a service line. So we talk about different things in that group. And so What I tell all of them is I would love for you to retire at Clinch Memorial Hospital. But if you aren't happy here, then I feel like it is my responsibility as a leader and as a CEO to equip you with every single tool to be able to get any job that you want and not be stuck in a job because you don't have any other choice. I said, so if you go work for a larger facility, if you become a senator or a congressman, I want you to remember some of the conversations we had, hard conversations at times, and say, you know what, I'm here because of this workshop and because we made the investment in them. And that's going to be my network in the future, Mark. I'm going to call on them in the future.
That's true. Yeah.
To leave the hospital and to ask a favor and stuff like that. So that's what we have a responsibility of doing that.
Well, that was incredibly powerful, Angela. I love what you said, you know, really solidify who you are. And you talk about growing your own, but it also sounds like, you know, really explaining the why behind the work and enabling your team to kind of expand. And you know, you also talked about, I think another thing I'd like to just hit on, you know, you talked about dropping out of school and here you are a CEO and look what everything you've accomplished. I mean, it's clear that you've learned a lot of resiliency.
A lot of mistakes have been made, Mark. I don't want to paint this picture like it was a yellow brick road. And so I think that's one of the things that I'm most proud of is I do have the ability to extend a lot of grace and mercy because I have needed it so much in my lifetime. But I also am able to set clear boundaries. And I have told myself a long time ago, I cannot want something more than you do. So I'm going to give you all of the resources and all the tools that I have the ability to. But if you don't work at it, I can't do anything about it. What got you here is not going to keep you here. And that is true for me. Just because I've got a contract signed, it doesn't mean that I don't have a certain expectation to perform constantly. And that award that we recently got from Georgia Hospital Association for Hospital of the Year, I just want to express that it does not mean perfection. In no way, shape, or form are we perfect. I hope that is a symbol of every time we're not down or we make a mistake, we get back up and we try to improve upon it. So that's what I think that word symbolizes. So as a leader, we need to extend that grace and mercy. But, you know, the road is hard enough for anybody, Mark. And I can just look back at all the times that I was struggling, that I was on my own, trying to go back to school with children, working as a bedside nurse. I mean, I've worked hard to get here. No one's given me anything, and I never felt like at any moment that I was owed anything. And so I have a very hard time when I am presented with people with that kind of mentality that something is owed. And, you know, we do an internship program at the hospital and have for many years, and it's just, it blows my mind the amount of people that are graduating from very prestigious programs, and they haven't worked yet, but they have this expectation that they're ready to be in a leadership position, but they have so many life skills that are lacking and so many experiences that are still lacking. That's surprising. And I would not want to wish my life on anyone, even though it is a great story, I will tell you, and I will not. I'm so glad that it was just Polaroids back in the day and we didn't have social media for a lot of that. But It's been not an easy road, and there are a lot of things that I wish that I could have had a mentor or a peer say, Angela, let's not go down this route. Or if I just had someone giving me a little bit more guidance, then I think it could have been a little bit more laser focused back in the day. But I think that most people, and I remember listening to this podcast, reading this book, it's about the, and help me out, Mark, but it's the founder's philosophy, the founding father's philosophy.
Yes.
That most of the people and great inventions and things like that are developed because of a lack or a significant need in that person's life. And so there's this quest of never having that feeling of starvation again, or that feeling of shame, or that feeling of poverty. So they work so hard to develop something or create something or invent something or build this business. And then it's kind of lost in the other generations, because it's easier. So I do think that there is something to be said about leaders who've had experience a little bit of lack and challenges, that it does develop some kind of street smarts that haven't been there before.
Well, that's very powerful, Angela. And yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And of course, you know, we talk about with our own kids is, you know, we don't want them to maybe struggle as much as we have, but there's something coming out of that struggle that teaches that resiliency and that also that confidence and that ability to know when you need to ask for help and, you know, when you need to push.
That's true. I know. And it was hard for me. I try to overcompensate a little bit with my kids, maybe for the big birthday party or a larger than Christmas. But, you know, all my children worked, except for one, since they were 15 years old. Like, look, you've got to know how to clock in. You've got to understand to follow the rules outside of our home. You need to learn the value of how hard you work for that first dollar. So people call me the tiger mom. You know, when your kids go off to college and they take that 1 year philosophy or psychiatry, they want to come back after that first semester to have a discussion about, you know, mom, I've learned in psychiatry that maybe your parenting skills should have been so-and-so. I'm like, no, I don't want to hear it. You offer me no advice until you become a parent. Look,
absolutely. So you've been in the shoes, which you...
That's right. That's right. That's right.
Absolutely. Well, two questions to close I'd love to hit on is, you know, for the community member listening, you know, who wants to support Clinch Memorial, you know, what should they know or do?
That I really want to stress that it does matter. So I understand that a lot of people feel like that the service is bigger or better when you go to a larger city. And it's fun to go almost 45 minutes, an hour away because then you can shop and lunch. But our hospital is so dependent on every single dollar. So I cannot stress enough how important it is to get your prescriptions filled at our hospital pharmacy, to get your lab work done, your CT scans, to see our doctors, because you getting the services that you need right here at home, it is a convenience for you because you're not driving 45 minutes one way, but it does help keep our doors open. It really helps keep your families employed. So every single dollar matters. And I want them to understand that hospitals, just because we bill something does not mean that we are receiving that.
Yep.
We have a contract with all the insurers, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Advantage plans, and so forth. So just because we bill a dollar doesn't mean we're going to get a dollar. We may, depending on that contract, get 35 cents on the dollar, 10 cents on the dollar, nothing at all. So to understand that when we ask for a copay or deductible, that's also required because we contract with that provider and pay for what you need instead of trying to just always pay for what you want. Healthcare, I believe it is a privilege. I've traveled to so many countries and I have witnessed firsthand on medical missions. We have had so many people come to us for help. If you couldn't afford the insulin, you didn't get it. Their child died. So we live in a great country to where those services are available and you can get it. And there are programs that can help you get that. But understand too, there is a cost on our side.
Yes.
And just because we have these hospitals, it doesn't mean that we're able to afford every luxury of giving health care for free, because where is that payment going to come from?
Yeah.
It has to be paid for in some form or fashion. And just to understand that the biggest thing, the most impactful thing that they can do is shop local, which means get your services done at your local hospital and to utilize us and to use your voice. If you go to an urban hospital and the doctor says, well, we want to send you for the CT here, it's better if you get it here. Understand, no, it's not. You can choose to have that order sent back to your rural hospital and we can do that procedure. And then we can electronically send those results back. Just to understand that advocating for yourself in your hospital is hugely important for us.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really appreciate you sharing that. Let's flip just outside of the community. Let's talk about our lawmakers that may be able to shape some policy. What is, you know, one thing outside of Medicare Advantage that you think they truly understood?
Yeah, I've really been encouraged over this last couple of years because I've seen politicians on both sides understand that they need to preserve rural health care. So I think a lot of people understand that. I do believe that they understand the negative impact if rural hospitals continue to close, the burden that it places on the urban hospital. So I'm very grateful for that. I'm just hoping that when or asking for when laws are being written or that policy is being created, that you do go to every single person that has a voice And then the voice necessarily isn't the leader at the large urban hospital who has really, they can't speak for the smaller critical access rural hospitals, that all of us have a place at the table and that you listen to that. That's what I hope happens for future policy. And I think for the most part that there are some excellent rural CEOs that are called upon when they need that advice. But from a federal level and a state level, I would like to see more policy written specific to the smaller rural hospitals.
Yes. And, you know, you've mentioned it earlier about, you know, not every hospital is a cookie cutter. And so there is massive differences. And particularly when I talk to lawmakers, I mean, they talk about they want to protect the independence of hospitals. They want to stop these large health systems. But yet they keep seeming to create policy that's just fueling those mergers and acquisitions.
Well, and I spoke about the cybersecurity infrastructure that needs to be in place now. I really do think there's going to be a push that if we don't deploy all of these measures, then we can be penalized. And then whether in reimbursement or penalties and stuff like that. So, okay, so that push is going to happen. Give us the funding to make it happen. Yes. I do not have a CIO. I do not have a team of experienced IT people. We don't cannot afford to have attorneys who are employees of the hospital. So supplement the ability for us to meet those standards and those requirements.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Well, last one, Angela. Okay. So the work is clearly hard. You've certainly talked about some of the headwinds and that are real. And, you know, you're carrying it every day. You know, what does give you hope?
This amazing group of people that I work with. They are so passionate and they want to keep this hospital open. So the innovation, the hard work, the ability to make things happen, that gives me hope. That inspires me. They inspire me to do better every day. When I talk to my fellow CEOs, and I know they're in that fight with me, to know that we're all in this, and I say that loosely, battle together, that inspires me and gives me hope because I feel like I have to keep going for them. Because maybe some change that I implement will impact me in a positive way. And I am almost positive they feel the same way. I'm doing this work for my hospital, but I'm also doing the work for all the, my other friends' hospitals for rural healthcare. That gives me hope. And the push for protecting the rural hospital, I think the presence or I guess the desire to communicate our needs and people like you who want to host us on podcasts and other journalists who are trying to share the work that we're doing and also the struggles that we have and highlight that gives me hope. Because I feel like that either it's in this conversation or a news article or something else that would pop up that someone happens to listen to, that that will strike a chord in someone and they can be the change maker that could make the legislation, the policy and stuff be created because they heard one of us speaking about the challenges or the work that we're doing. That gives me a lot of hope. And well, the people that serve and the feedback that we get, you know, I wish that I could say that this work is going to be easy. And I go back to that question you asked me about, well, what would you say to someone starting to in this role as a brand new person? Change will never happen overnight. Okay. And trust is never built overnight. So trust and change is built in the relationships that you invest in. So if you want to breeze in and that like, oh, I am here, I'm going to save the day, this never happened. So that's not the stance that you need to take. You really need to get involved in your community. You need to get involved with the people that you are working with at the hospital and create those relationships. And I think the average turnover for a rural hospital CEO is every 3 years. What can you build in 3 years?
Yeah.
What can be built really in 3 years? There could be the foundation of something, but I think good momentum and good evolution of practice happens over a longer tenure of time. So don't be so quick to say, okay, onward to bigger and better. Because I mean, all of my team does get recruited. I get recruited to go to another health system. I have considered it. And then I remember why I'm here and I am serving a purpose. And even though it may not be in New York City, it may not be in Atlanta, and it doesn't have the name of a world-renowned facility, does not mean that we're not making a difference. and that we're not doing good things and that we are not smart people or not capable people. So the purpose that we are, that we have here is hugely important to me. And it's not everyone doesn't have the ability or be able to say that I get to wake up and go into every day to be excited about going into a job that I love and to love the people that I work with. But I am honored that I do have the ability to say that. And that is a very rare thing to find. And I'm very grateful for that.
Well, I love that. That was really powerful. And, you know, I love you explaining your purpose and also how trust and change doesn't happen overnight. So that was really well said. Well, Angela, I have had so much fun talking to you and hearing your story, which is absolutely remarkable. And can't thank you enough for coming on the show.
Well, thank you, Mark.
That's a wrap on today's episode of the Regional Hospital Voice. If this conversation reminded you why this work matters, share it. Send it to a colleague, a fellow leader, someone who needs to hear that they're not alone in what they're carrying. The leaders on this show aren't just telling their stories, they're building something. A coalition of voices proving that regional hospitals are worth fighting for and that the people running them deserve to be heard. And we're just getting started. New episodes drop every week. Each one, a new leader, a new story, and another piece of the bigger picture of what's really happening in regional healthcare across America. And don't miss what's coming. Follow the Regional Hospital Voice wherever you listen to podcasts and come back next week. Until then, thank you for the work you do every single day for our hospitals and for our communities.